captain wired in, he had water coming in, and the good ship and crew was in peril. Later that night, when his lights went out of sight, came the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Gordon Lightfoot on WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. It was 50 years ago tonight that the Edmund Fitzgerald sunk in the stormy waters, I was going to say seas, because it was like a hurricane out there, of Lake Superior. It rests today as a protected burial site more than 500 feet below the surface of the lake. And we're looking back at that fateful day, as well as the legacy of the Edmund Fitzgerald and what came after. Our guest, first, you know, Steve Ackerman. He is one half of the Weather Guys. He's an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and he's been going around the state giving talks on the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And Steve, always a welcome guest on the Larry Mueller Show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks. It's great to be here. It's a great story.
It is
and
indeed.
And sad story.
Yeah, and it's become such a pop culture icon that almost like the story gets lost in the whatever it came in the 50 years after, including that song.
Right.
Also joining us today, Frederick Stonehouse. He is a maritime historian who's written more than 30 books on the subject, including the seminal, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And Frederick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
And we want to invite you to the conversation as well. If you have stories about the fateful November 10th, 1975, you are welcome to join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. If you have questions about that night or the Edmund Fitzgerald itself, you can also join us. Now, there are still some questions remaining about what happened on November 10th, 1975. But everything else, you've got the answers from our guests, Steve Ackerman and Frederick Stonehouse. And Frederick, I want to begin with you, and let's begin with Edmund Fitzgerald. Who was Edmund Fitzgerald?
He was the president of the Northwest Mutual Life Insurance Company located in Milwaukee.
And this company was the owner at the time when the Edmund Fitzgerald set out on the Great Lakes, 1958?
Well, there were a couple things in play there, and number one, it was the tremendous amount of money that the life insurance companies were making, and buying an ore carrier, having one built and run by another company, in effect, the lease arrangement, was a viable profit center. So they were going to do it, and it's also worth understanding that Edmund Fitzgerald, as the ship is named after, had, I think it was five uncles, all of which were involved with shipping as captains. So really, Edmund was the oddball that went into the insurance business as opposed to being a seafarer.
So he had nothing to do with the seas, and yet
not a thing. But he had that emotional connection.
Yeah, this wasn't any freighter though, Frederick. This was 729 feet long, and at the time that it launched was the longest freighter on the Great Lakes.
She was indeed, until the 1,000-footers began to come out in the early 1970s. She was also the pride of the line. She was the biggest on the lake, the fastest on the lake, set cargo record after cargo record after cargo record, pride of the line in every respect. She was the freighter that if you were a sailor on the lakes, you wanted to sail on Fitz. You wanted to be the second cook if that was the job open. You wanted to be the second mate if that was the job open. That's how the regard that it was held in.
That's amazing. And yet, on November 9th, 1975, it set out from Superior, Wisconsin. Steve Ackerman, what do we know about what was taking place around the Great Lakes on this date?
So on that day, on the 9th, it was a beautiful day. You know, when you look at the weather that was happening in that morning, the storm was developing off of the panhandle of Oklahoma, east of the Rocky Mountains. That's a classic place where these storms, these really nasty storms that we've had in the Great Lake regions, seem to get organized, and then working with the jet stream that comes right up towards Lake Superior. So the forecast from the National Weather Service at the time was looking at the development of that storm and expected it to get to the Great Lakes, just not in the strength of which it ended up hitting it.
So, Frederick, the Edmund Fitzgerald knew a storm was coming. How did they prepare for their trip to the Detroit area?
Well, I don't think they did anything it's really different than they would have done otherwise. Certainly both captains, all three captains too, including Dudley on the Winifred Sykes, looked at the lake charts available, the weather charts available, and determined they were going to run the North Shore. In other words, if you've got a predominant north wind coming down, you don't want to buck into that, so you'll tend to run more to the North Shore of Superior, where you will have some wind shelter from it as you make your long run down and eventually the turn at Whitefish and into the Sioux Locks. Conversely, if the winds were strongly from the south, you would buckle into the southern route. Or if you were a salty and not very educated in things Great Lake weathery, you would go right down the middle of the lake and have your have your head handed you on a napkin. It's interesting. You only see them do it once.
In the their standard route, Fred, do they take the southern route or go down the center of the Lake Superior?
Well, obviously, where's the weather? What's the best course I should be following? And that's the way they go.
Yeah.
Okay. So they changed their course because they know a storm is coming. But ultimately, was that the wrong decision? Because did they end up getting buffeted by these waves that came up? They were described as like hurricane-like weather on the Great Lakes. Is that what we're experiencing? And are those waves the same as what we would have seen in the Atlantic coming in?
So it's not quite hurricane. So as a meteorologist, I have to point, it's not quite hurricanes. we have a definition of how strong even a weak hurricane has to been, and those sustained winds weren't even being matched yet.
Okay.
But, you know, in terms of the song and the way people describe it, it gives an idea of what was happening.
The gales of November.
The gales of November. That's what it was. We've seen these gales before. And they went to the northern route in order, as Fred was saying, to get some protection from Canada, because what generates big waves is strong winds, sustained strong winds over a long period of time, over deep water, and over a large fetch or an open area of water. And by going the northern route, based on the forecast, that fetch would have been smaller. The storm intensified faster. The National Weather Service kept updating based on continued input on what was happening with the storm. And as it turned out, the storm, when it reached its peak, the winds were coming out of the coming out of the northwest. So right along the lakes, right along the biggest part of the fetch.
Yeah.
And so that generated 25, 30-foot waves. So that put them in the bad spot.
25, 30-foot waves. How high was the Edmund Fitzgerald above water level in Lake Superior? Do we know that, Frederick?
Yes, we do. We'll come in and say about 11 feet. So, freeboard.
So you're getting 25 to 30 foot waves on a ship that is almost 730 feet long, but only 11 feet above the waterline.
Yeah.
Yes.
but
she came out of the shipyard, I think, at 14 or 13 and change.
So
she had been, her load lines had been adjusted through the years.
But the Edmund Fitzgerald wasn't the only ship on the freighter on the water that day, was it, Frederick?
Nope. Not a bit. There were another dozen out there.
And yet the Edmund Fitzgerald was the only one that sunk. And there are still some questions as to what occurred in the immediate aftermath of the message that came from Captain Ernest McSorley, who said simply, We are holding our own. And yet they weren't. What do we know about the instances that occurred after that message was sent by Captain McSorley, Frederick?
You mean after?
Yeah.
Well, after, and this is where Cooper gets all the credit, I think, a great deal of credit for dealing with the Coast Guard and trying to explain the differential between a missing 16-foot boat that the Coast Guard watchstander in Sault Ste. Marie was trying to get the Anderson all excited about versus the missing iron ore carrier with 29 men on board. The Coast Guard was reluctant to do anything. And that was really the fault of the way the command system was set up in the Sioux and who made decisions when and how. But that certainly did result in a lessening in immediate Coast Guard action. Would that have made any difference in the total outcome of the disaster? Probably not under the circumstances.
Oh,
but what was amazing to me, Fred, was that the Coast Guard asked the Anderson to go back and look for it. And they did, which is must have been harrowing.
So the Anderson was trailing the Edmund Fitzgerald.
The Anderson was traveling with it. At that time, the Fitzgerald had lost its radar. The navigation at Whitefish, I think it was out. So the Anderson was in contact with the Fitzgerald, giving them directions, letting them know where they were and whether or not, you know, when other ships went by, if it was okay in terms of safety.
Would the storm have prevented the Coast Guard from seeking an immediate rescue? Was it the weather conditions that caused the pause before anybody could look for for people?
No.
Huh.
In my mind, in my view, it is not. It was a pure ineptitude on their part.
Wow.
They had two major vessels on the Great Lakes at that time. They had the icebreaker Mackinaw, and they had one of the 180s. Both of them were down lakes, in other words, out of Lake Superior, and I believe ahead of it up at Sheboygan, under repair. And it was under repair for planned maintenance. In other words, they had taken them out of service with the expectation they would fix them over the period of a month or so that required. Nothing unusual there, except doing it in the middle of the worst month of the year for shipwrecks. It was crazy. Just unacceptable. Likewise, when they got to Traverse City and the air station assets, they were not ready to go on call. So there were delays that occurred along the way that could have made a difference.
Very interesting.
Maybe.
Yeah, well,
you always, when you talk shipwrecks on Lake Superior and the Great Lakes, you always circle back to Dennis Hale and the Morrell and being the sole survivor and how he survived literally on a life raft surrounded by his dead friends who broke the wind for him conveniently and unexpectedly.
When was that?
That was 1966.
That's 1966. As I understand it,
that was 66, right.
There were two shipwrecks in the 20 years prior on the Great Lakes where more than 20 sailors died in each of those shipwrecks. This wasn't an uncommon event, at least until the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, because one of the legacies of this story has to be 50 years to the day that it sunk, is we have not had a commercial freighter sink on the Great Lakes since then. And that is not by accident.
That is correct, but you forgot the Cedarville, which was hit by a Norwegian vessel up in northern Lake Huron. Loss of only 10 men. Sorry about that. We didn't make the bar. But serious disasters occurring up to the run of the Fitzgerald, and we haven't had one since.
And there,
what year was the Cedarville?
That was 50, I'm crumbling here, 58, I think, 57, 57.
Mm. Wow. So it wasn't uncommon in the Great Lakes. And yet, after the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald 50 years ago today, we have not seen it since. And that is not by accident. We're telling the story of the Edmund Fitzgerald and the 29 lives lost in Lake Superior 50 years ago with our guest, Steve Ackerman and Frederick Stonehouse. Frederick's the author of The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, a seminal work about the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And Steve Ackerman's been going around the state giving talks as the emeritus professor in the UW-Madison Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. If you have a story to tell about November 10th, 1975, or if you have a question of your own, we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email us talk@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to WPR News. Did you know that the tallest building in the state of Wisconsin is U.S. Bank Center in Milwaukee? It stands at 601 feet tall. I tell you this because the Edmund Fitzgerald, for reference, was 729 feet long, the longest freighter on the Great Lakes when it launched in 1958. And today is the 50th anniversary of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald and the 29 lives lost on that day. And we're talking about it with our guest, Frederick Stonehouse, a maritime historian and author of The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, and Steve Ackerman, emeritus professor in the UW-Madison Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And Steve, for those like me who are in South Central Wisconsin, may not get up to Superior very often, did get to Bayfield and Bloom earlier this year, paint the scene for us on Lake Superior. It is an inland ocean.
It is an inland ocean. I mean, the size of it, if you could take all the other lakes and pour them into Lake Michigan, and then a few more Lake Eries in there as well. I mean, that's how big it is. I think it's the second biggest lake, freshwater lake in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also quite cold. I grew up in New York and we were, did swimming in the ocean all the time. When I heard that the Fitzgerald went down, I could not believe that it sank in a lake. And then when you see the lake and it's, horizon to horizon is fresh water and very cold water, I think you get a real appreciation of what those glaciers did back many years ago.
And how does that impact the weather systems in the Great Lake area?
A lot. Mm-hmm. And I think we're experiencing it in terms of Lake Michigan today, in terms of lake effect snowfall. As storms go over there, when the waters are not frozen in particular, there's an exchange of water vapor coming off the lakes that can feed those storms and make them more severe.
So, Frederick Stonehouse, when we look at the Great Lakes as a shipping channel, as a commercial enterprise, how important were the Great Lakes in 1975 and today to the industrial work that is going on in the Great Lakes states?
Well, you can look at that a number of different ways. What's going on within the Great Lakes Basin, of course, they're the key for the movement of iron ore, or actually taconite has been for some time, rather than the direct shipping ore. But that is a vital, vital commodity for the steel industry, both U.S. and Canadian. And it's really just on the—you have to step back and take a really good look at it to realize how valuable it is and understand it. But we're increasingly seeing—we are used to be seeing increased amounts of international shipping coming into the lake system. That is, in my mind, dropping off somewhat radically as the system doesn't change and the ships do.
Hmm.
In other words, when they built the St. Lawrence Seaway, somewhere around 10% of world shipping, 12% could come through it. Now you're down to about 4.5%. So,
just because of the size of the channels?
Size of the lock system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got a whole lock system that's in the St. Lawrence River. You've got another lock system as you move through the Welland Canal. You've got another lock system when you get to Lake Superior. All of them limit the size of shipping and therefore the economic viability of it.
And Steve Ackerman, go ahead.
I was just going to say, that said, it still is very important, but you can see the writing clearly on the wall.
And as the Edmund Fitzgerald would go through the Sioux Locks, it became, as I understand it and have read the stories, a sort of an event. People would show up to cheer. There would be a captain on the Edmund Fitzgerald that would play classical music through the speakers as they were traveling through the Sioux Locks. It was an event.
Yeah, and I think we first saw that event when it was launched, and there were 10, I've seen numbers between 10 and 15,000 people showed up to see it. And I don't think that interest ever died out.
Yeah.
As you had mentioned, I've been giving some talks around the state, and people are coming up to me and giving me pictures about, when they went to see it with their dad or their mom or their pop because they heard that they could get it, that it was going through the lock at a particular time. So I think that interest in the Great Lakes region certainly has sustained throughout the entire life. It wasn't just the song. The song made it popular. But there was, and more broadly popular across the U.S. and the globe, but the interest in the Great Lakes area was always there.
Let's go to your questions now at 1-800-642-1234. Jim in Rice Lake, good afternoon.
Hi, I'm a pleasure sailor on Lake Superior. There's a local yacht club whose nickname or motto is Sail a Real Lake, and on Superior the joke should be it's just Sail a Real Nasty Lake. You can get. I've experienced on a sunny day in September, 45-mile-an-hour winds come out of nowhere.
Wow,
straight line. But anyway, my question is the cause of the sinking.
Yeah,
I think there have been drones that have gone down to explore the wreck. It's my understanding that everyone accepts that water got through the cargo latches and holes, and that water taconite is absorbent. It absorbed water from the water that got into the hold, and it broke the ship in half in the middle. The question becomes, what is the cause of this? Was it possible crew negligence, or was it negligent maintenance of the vessel over time, which I've also heard? And certainly, was there possible potential negligence to a certain degree in the design of the boat because of its length and the height that you've mentioned? A 700-foot boat that's 11 feet high, but I'll interested in your in your analysis as to whether it is one of these three factors or a combination. Thank you.
You stay safe out on Lake Superior there, Jim. And Frederick, the Stonehouse, this is right in your wheelhouse.
You betcha. Anything you want to believe is true. Anything you want to believe. If you want little flying saucers coming down that broke the ship, that works too.
I don't think that's how it works, Frederick, but I appreciate
it works because nobody knows. No smoking gun has been found, and that's been after four different trips down there with the submersibles. The Canadians, of course, have shut it off, the diving activity, expedition activity, and as well as anything that is disturbing of the graveyard environment of the wreck. So you're not going to be able to go down and take another look at it. I've been involved in three of the different surveys that have gone out there using the best technology we could find, and sat down with the experts, the marine architects and related folks, to look at that video footage again and again and again, and you find absolutely totally nothing that tells you what happened. Huh. If you want to believe something, you can believe it. But there is no proof at the end of that belief system.
So the questions about what actually sunk the Edmund Fitzgerald will remain. Steve, I want to bring you into this because Jim had also mentioned 45-mile-an-hour winds just popping up in Lake Superior on a sunny day, and that sounded like kind of what the National Weather Service was saying on November 9th, 1975, but they did change their tune over the next day.
They did change their tune as the storm developed, and their forecasts were updated continually. Again, a thing to remember, two things I think to remember. One is in 1975, the numerical weather prediction was really still about a decade old at most. So we were still learning what you needed to do to get an accurate forecast.
You need to look into your phone and it'll tell you the next 10 days pretty well. But in 1975, we're a long way from that.
We're a long way. What one-day forecast in terms of accuracy in 1975 is equivalent to a five-day forecast today.
Wow.
So that's how much we've improved. The other thing is the caller mentioned three of the theories afloat of what brought the ship down. The other thing not to forget is the weather. The weather played a key role. I mean, other ships survived. That's definitely true. But if it was a beautiful day like it was on November 9th, 1975, would that ship have gone down? I would bet probably not.
The image in my mind, Steve, that I have is a 730-foot freighter with waves that are holding up two ends and then an eddy in the middle that is where the largest portion of the body of the Edmund Fitzgerald is unsupported, and it's got all that taconite or iron ore in there, and it wouldn't be able to support itself. Yeah, that's what my mind eye goes to.
Yeah, and that's one of the rogue wave theories, I think, where you can get these 25, 30-foot observed waves. They can interact, so they can actually be bigger than that. And sometimes you see that in the ocean a lot, and that's why they call them rogue waves. All of a sudden, you get a big thing across. I don't really think that that's
a likely scenario.
Fred may have a different opinion, but
well, we know what Fred. Your opinion's right. Whatever it is,
so it's not happening. Right.
Call him in. It is worth thinking. I mean, you can build clues for all of these things. You can build clues that the fence rail went down on one of the reports from Fitzgerald to the Anderson. And, of course, the fence rail is not going to break unless you're somehow hogging the vessel. So that would be a precursor to breaking in two on the surface. There's a little evidence there that could go that way. You could also go the other way of not having this, or having only screen, not having, only having screen bulkheads, not waterproof bulkheads. So you've got the migration of water that would enter cargo holes, if assuming something is leaking to put the water in the cargo hole. Mm-hmm. So you can make a case. You can sit down and make a pretty viable case for almost any of the major theories.
And maybe that's where part of the story of the Edmund Fitzgerald continues, because we just will never know. As one of the families of the lost, I believe, said, there are 30 people who know, 29 on that ship and God. Mm-hmm. Other than that, we will still guess. And Frederick, I am curious about the families of the 29 lost in the Edmund Fitzgerald. How, you know, this tragedy was popularized less than a year later by the song by Gordon Lightfoot that we heard earlier. And what the legacy is for those who have lost somebody from the Edmund Fitzgerald, Frederick?
They are a very different group. They are not homogeneous by any means. Many folks love the Lightfoot Ballad. Others do not. Many folks want to see diving increased out there. Some folks do not.
Hmm.
Some folks are searching for answers. Others are not. They're people.
Yeah.
And they've been yanked into an untenable position of having a news guy put a microphone up to their mouth every year to say, how do you feel? It's that, you know, come on. There's not always a lot of reality, I think, being used, and we need to be able to use that.
As I understand it, no bodies have been recovered from the Edmund Fitzgerald.
No bodies have been recovered or proven to identify with the Fitzgerald.
And that the wreckage site remains a protected burial site by the Canadian government, as it appears to be just over the boundary line.
By survey, it is in Canadian waters, and yes, they have put a ban on that activity.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the legacy of the Edmund Fitzgerald with our guest, Frederick Stonehouse, the author of The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, and Steve Ackerman, who's been giving talks around the state. He's the emeritus professor in the UW-Madison Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Taking your questions and stories along the way at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Don in Dairyland next. Don, good afternoon.
Hello. I have a question. Years ago, I worked at the Fraser Nelson Shipyard in Superior. And the next year that I went to work there was in the wintertime. The Edmund Fitzgerald was in dry dock.
Hmm.
And it was rammed on midsection.
Hmm.
And there was a lot of structural damage to it at that point. I didn't stay there to work or continue working on it because I hadn't paid my union dues and from the previous overlay from the summer, and I was a young guy just getting ready to go to college.
Go get another gig.
But I often wondered the damage that was that happened at that time.
Do you know what year this would have been done? What year you were working in this dock?
I'm thinking it was around 69.
Interesting.
69, I think.
Frederick, do we know anything about the midsection of the Edmund Fitzgerald being rammed?
Yep. That occurred. It wasn't serious. I forgot the date or the circumstance of it. She's been knocked about like most of the ships. I mean, they're working freighters, and they hit lock walls. They bang up. They do these things. And I'm going to say you just live with it, but you bring it in the yard, you repair it, you put it back. The assumption we would have to make is that it was properly surveyed and properly repaired.
Just part of the life of a commercial freighter on the Great Lakes, I guess.
It is indeed. I mean, just stand back on shore, watch them go by, and you'll see the scrape marks, for example, along the hull. they ride the lock walls going in. They ride the lock walls going out.
Sure.
Some of the masters are wonderful ship handlers. It strikes me as being normal, though perhaps for people not used to working with it, it becomes something else.
Steve Ackerman, as we mentioned, there has not been a commercial freighter sinking in the Great Lakes since the Edmund Fitzgerald sunk 50 years ago today. It's not by accident. What's changed?
A couple of things changed. One is some of the shipping rules. As you were pointing out, and I think Fred points it out in his book, is that, you know, there is some indications that there were some fractures or things that needed to be repaired on the Fitz that weren't repaired. You know, they were going to repair the next year.
Save some money.
As well. Right. And, you know, it sounds trivial, but yeah, time is money and load is money.
The name Edmund Fitzgerald goes back to the investment that this boat was.
Right. They did it for resources, mm-hmm. for money. And of course, weather forecasting has significantly improved. When we look at storms that have hit the Great Lakes, there was a storm in the Armistice Day of 1940, was pretty much the same storm as the storm that sank the Edmund Fitzgerald. And over 150 people died in that storm.
Oh, wow.
A lot of them duck hunters because they were caught by surprise. They didn't know the storm was coming. In 1998, we had another storm, pretty much exactly the same as the Fitzgerald storm. 10 people died because of that storm, a lot of it associated with flying debris, so the wind-blown debris or knocking things over.
Huh.
But we knew that storm was coming. That storm was well forecast. And if we maintain that era of really doing good forecasting, then people will be warned that this nasty storm is coming, provided we can communicate to them about it. But
we also have 130 buoys in the Great Lakes that are taking in data. And how many did we have before the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald?
Zero.
What do those buoys do?
So they make weather observations, you know, like we see them on stations. They also do wave heights as well in the condition of the sea. But they're providing information on temperature, pressure, wind speed, and wind directions. And from that, you have an idea now of what is occurring on the lakes and how to feed that into the surrounding observations on land in order to do a more accurate weather forecast.
And Frederick, how important is that to commercial transport on the Great Lakes?
Let me answer that by just being a little bit different. The single federal agency that really stepped forward after Fitzgerald, that really took the reports and the criticism to hand and fixed their problem that they didn't fix previously, and that was the Weather Service. They did a magnificent job of pushing technology down on the lakes, as Dr. Ackerman pointed out. They gave us a system that we can be proud of. That also included, of course, satellite use, et cetera. But it was the Weather Service that really deserves our accolades for what they've done, and the thanks of every mariner on the Great Lakes.
Wow. It's interesting because the National Weather Service has come up in the talks that the weather guys have had with Larry Mueller recently, and concerns over federal budget cuts that may impact the National Weather Service. What would that impact mean for commercial transport on the Great Lakes, Steve?
Well, for commercial transport or for everyone, it's going to be worse forecasting. The thing that feeds the models and does the prediction is not just the models, it's the weather, current weather data that goes into those models. Mm-hmm. And when you start doing budget cuts, and instead of, for example, instead of having two radio sons twice a day coming out of Oklahoma, you only have one.
That's half the data.
That's half the data. And that those are the storms that are going to hit the Great Lakes. Right? Mm-hmm. They come out of the panhandles of Oklahoma. It's one of those areas. So it's undoubtedly, they're also shutting down the buoy system, as I've heard.
What?
And also the other 50th anniversary that's being celebrated is the GOES satellites. So when you watch in the evening and you watch the news and you see all the clouds move, those observations began in October 1975. And now the satellites have gotten more sophisticated. We can do more observations with them. The last GOES was launched, and the current administration, as I understand it, has no plans to continue that program. And, you know, that means the weather forecasts are going to be going down, the capability, the accuracy.
And the safety.
And the safety, therefore.
Yeah. Pardon me. Frederick Stonehouse and Steve Ackerman, our guests on this day, the 50th anniversary of the loss of the Edmund Fitzgerald and the 29 lives that perished with it. Your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org with the time that we have left. I'm Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to WPR News. For more on the loss and the legacy of the Edmund Fitzgerald, I want to encourage you to go to WPR.org and check out the stories today from Danielle Kading, who looks at the families who lost somebody and the legacy that's left there. And Bridget Bowden's story about a new children's book featuring the Edmund Fitzgerald. That's all available for you at your leisure or right now at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and our guest, Frederick Stonehouse, the maritime historian and author of The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, and Steve Ackerman, emeritus professor in the UW-Madison Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, as well as one half of the weather guys who are here on a regular basis on The Larry Mueller Show. And your questions with the time we have left. We'll start with Ron in La Crosse. Ron, good afternoon.
Yes. In addition, your guest mentioned something about November storm that occurred almost 35 years earlier to the day. And here in the local area, we call it the Armistice Day storm. And, yes, I guess there were many fatalities, and most of them were probably duck hunters that were out on the Mississippi River south of La Crosse. And it was beautiful weather. The day started on November 11th, you know, gorgeous weather. And the duck hunters were having a field day. And I think what happened as the storm got closer from Minnesota, the ducks were probably started fleeing the storm front, and they started converging in the, you know, the southern half of Mississippi south of La Crosse.
It was fish in a barrel.
Yeah, yeah, shooting ships in a barrel. I think if they'd been Native Americans, the Indians, they would have probably started rowing their canoes to shore, because I think they probably were familiar with that type of balmy weather in November. So, you know, there were many fatalities, and it's been talked about for decades.
The Armistice Day?
The Armistice Day storm of 1940.
Yeah, and when you mentioned the deaths, Stephen, I thought on the Great Lakes. I didn't think on the Mississippi.
As he was pointing out, I think it was like over 50 duck hunters in Wisconsin were killed, as well as over 40 in Minnesota as well. And as Ron was pointing out, it was a beautiful day on the 9th, and it was duck hunting season, and it's Armistice Day, now Veterans Day, called Veterans Day. And so they went out duck hunting, and then the storm caught them by surprise. Temperatures dropped by 40 degrees in 4 hours. There was 16 inches of snow in places in Minnesota. It destroyed the apple industry in Iowa.
Sure.
So that's why they grow corn now. It was really bad, really bad storm.
And that's why they grow corn now.
And that's why they grow corn, because it was too expensive to replant all the orchards in that area.
Let's go to Frederick next in Minnesota. Frederick, good afternoon.
Hi, interesting program. My dad was always interested in this because he worked while he was in high school the summer of 1943 on the lakes on the Henry B. Dalton freighter. And then in World War II, he was in the Merchant Marine. And he always talked about the one of the times he was scared. They got caught in one of those typhoons. He was up on the bridge, and they were looking at waves coming. They were looking up at waves coming at them. But anyway, some years ago, he gave me a book, and I believe it was written by the captain of the Arthur Anderson, who said or claimed that the Fitzgerald was due to go into dry dock after that trip to have its keel repaired. Don't know if that's true or not.
Great question, Frederick. And the Arthur Anderson was trailing behind the Edmund Fitzgerald as it traveled through Superior on this stormy day 50 years ago. And Frederick Stonehouse, what do we know about the captain of the Arthur Anderson's claims?
Well, we know that that's claim number 23-7.
Point taken.
It's one of the top eight.
Well, yeah, and you know, Frederick, the way we talk about the theories of what actually sunk the Edmund Fitzgerald, it seems like any of these are viable theories, and that there was some real vulnerabilities to this ship before it sank, vulnerabilities that we don't necessarily see today, which would suggest maybe this tragedy was a bigger watershed than we initially thought it would be, or that we give it credit for.
Well, I think you're right. And, you know, certainly these are viable alternatives to what sunk it. We don't know what sunk it. We arguably never will, or maybe not.
But it could have been any of these things. It could have been, you know, maintenance delayed. It could have been the weather itself and the waves that sunk it. It could have been the iron ore that it was carrying, and how much it was carrying, and how close it kept it to the water level. And these are things that are questions that will remain as we go forward. And your guess is as good as anybody else's at this point, 50 years to the day later. Kathy in Superior, we'll go to you next. Good afternoon.
Oh, hello. Yes, I saw on television that there were long train waves that evening, and that the back of the ship and the front of the ship were in between the long train wave, and well, they were up on it, and there was nothing in the middle, and the ship stunk from that for that reason.
That's kind of what's been in. That's the way I picture it, Kathy. And yet there's really no answer. But what do we know about long train waves, Steve?
So we do know that there were really big waves on the Lake Superior at the time. Observations being made by various ships on the lake at the time. We're looking at 25, 30-foot waves. When we run our models today, knowing what the winds were, theoretically, again, they were producing 25 to 30-foot waves as well. So there's no surprise they had the big waves, and they're probably bigger than that at time when they hooked together. But as you know, Fred is pointing out, that's one of the theories that still people talk about in terms of getting caught between them. I think that's an interesting visualization.
Right. It's easier to see.
It's easy to see. I don't know how hard that is actually to support a lake that way.
And some of these questions will just never be answered. And we'll go to Chris in Fairchild next. Chris, good afternoon.
Yes. So my question is as to the age of the fleet on the lakes right now. It's my understanding that the youngest boat in the ship fleet is roughly 40 years old. When are we due to see some turnover? Now, granted, these are freshwater and probably have a little bit longer of a lifespan, but again, safety on the lake is of paramount. What about seeing some turnover in some of these ore ships?
Chris, great question. Frederick Stonehouse, what do we know about the age of the Great Lakes fleet, commercial fleet as it stands today?
Average age will be 50.
Wow.
The Mishapa Cotton, you may have heard about her last year when she had the structural crack up by Isle Royal. Again, she was built in 25, so she's about 72 years old and still sailing, theoretically. Though I did see her in the yard at Fraser's when we were up there like a few days ago.
What's the lifespan of one of these commercial freighters?
Last ship, I'm sorry?
What's the typical lifespan of these commercial freighters, Frederick?
It is very dependent. We have some that have been on the lake for 100 years. As long as you maintain the vessel, you change out the engine, you do the things you need to for good maintenance, you can do it. But again, more typical on the lakes is going to be 50.
And a couple of years ago, I was up in Duluth at a curling bunch, Bill, up there. And as we went by the shoreline there, the Anderson was docked.
You're kidding me. The one that was trailing the Edmund Fitzgerald 50 years ago.
Right. And I got really excited, and my colleagues thought, what is wrong with that? I think the Anderson is still operating, or maybe this is the last year. Do you know, Fred?
Yeah, she's pretty much on the block for going away. Yeah.
Okay.
In other words, she'll be scrapped out. That seems to be the verdict.
Yeah.
But how old was Arthur Anderson 50 years ago?
She would have been somewhere, 50 years ago, I don't recall the build date on her, but I'm imagining right now she's somewhere right around 60, 65.
Yeah. Well,
I think around the same age as what the Fitzgerald would have been.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. Again, you've got them all in the same area, too. You've got Fitzgerald running with the same specs as Anderson is running. And then you go back off and look at the Sykes, and you've got, again, this other boats of the same general vintage and capability, and you would argue capability of fighting off a windstorm or related.
So if Edmund Fitzgerald had not sunk 50 years ago today, it arguably could still be operational on the Great Lakes.
Oh, certainly.
Very interesting. I got an email here from Phil in Bayfield. He says, one thing that he learned from your book, Frederick, is that the Edmund Fitzgerald was not equipped with a depth sounder. And Phil says he finds this hard to understand.
Most rational people do find it hard to understand. I mean, this is a $200 device you can buy in Kmart, right? Or you could have bought in Kmart. No, Coast Guard did not require it, so the companies did not provide it.
But they
even
do
worse,
now.
Coast Guard did not require an EPIRB, so the companies did not provide it.
So regulations for these commercial freighters, did they change after the Edmund Fitzgerald sunk?
Radically.
Was it because of the Edmund Fitzgerald?
Directly because of the Fitzgerald.
Wow. So
they looked at the boats entirely differently. They conducted pre-storm weather or storm season checklists and other inspection items. they did the things that you and I might consider to be common sense.
Right, but if they're not mandated, then and you could save some money doing it, this was a investment venture to begin with, as the name of the Edmund right. Fitzgerald suggests, so you would, if you could, probably waylay those costs. Michael emailed to ask whether or not Lake Superior has the capacity to create its own weather, Steve.
For sure. I took a breath there because, well, what do you mean by its own weather?
Right.
It's not going to generate a hurricane, for example, but a good example of it creating its own weather, two good examples, I think, would be the lake effect snowfall.
Buffalo, New York was
Buffalo,
one
New York
thing I
is
think
another.
Of.
Right,
it
yeah.
just sits there and collects snow off the Great Lakes all winter long.
I mean, as a storm, as a cold air flows over it, if it's any kind of dynamics, that water vapor is going to, the water on the lake is going to evaporate and feed the storm, and you're going to get dumped with 2 feet of snow mm-hmm. on the coastline. I think also around the lakes, particularly this time of year, you get a lot of fog.
Yeah,
And that's directly related to the lake and fog as weather, so you can be answer it that way as well, that yes, it can generate its own weather.
Frederick, you've been steeped in this for decades now, and as a maritime historian, I'm curious how you look back on this day and the meaning of the Edmund Fitzgerald and its legacy to you.
There's two meanings. Number one, I think it has the meaning of acting as a surrogate for all of the other shipwreck we've had in the lakes of 6,500 or so that we have. And I think that by honoring the Fitzgerald, we are in effect also honoring those ships at the same time. So I think that's important. I think it's very important to do this, what we're doing for the Fitzgerald, simply because it realizes the fact that for the Great Lakes sailors, the Fitzgerald was yesterday. It's with them. They know it. They understand it. They're not afraid of it, but it means that they're navigation now is a lot safer and a lot more careful and a lot more considered than it was back before Fitzgerald. You can see that when you pop open your iPad and go to marinetraffic.com and watch the ships.
Sure.
When the lake is really bad and kicking out there and the big waves are rolling, you find out you can easily see that the fleet, the Great Lakes fleet, is hugging the shore or at shelter. They're not bucking into the middle of it.
And Steve, as you've gone around the state and talked about this tragedy and what it has meant to the Great Lakes region and to commercial shipping, what's the reaction been like? What's it like when people talk about the Edmund Fitzgerald? Is it about Gordon Lightfoot? Is it about the 29 lives lost?
It's about the ship.
It's about the ship.
Yeah, nobody talks about Gordon Lightfoot.
Okay.
they talk about their experience seeing the ship or their experience being around the Great Lakes and dealing with those kind of weather events, or just really interested in knowing what happened to the Fitzgerald.
But we're never going to know.
But we're never going to know. Right?
So that mystery is just going to be part of the legacy of this tragedy.
Yes.
And one of the things that has come up from the Edmund Fitzgerald, the one thing that's come up from the Edmund Fitzgerald is the bronze bell from it, which I believe was rung in a ceremony in Washburn a couple weeks ago, 29 times for the 29 lives lost. Just a reminder about what happened 50 years ago today, the tragedy that ensued, and the legacy of it today that is keeping commercial freighters safer on the Great Lakes and our weather more accurate and precise. Frederick Stonehouse, thank you so much for joining us today, and I hope we have this opportunity again to talk about maritime history around the Great Lakes. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
He is also the author of The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, the seminal work on the tragedy. Steve Ackerman, Emeritus Professor of the UW-Madison Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, also one half of the Weather Guys. Looking forward to having you back soon on The Larry Mueller Show.
Yep, thank you, and I look forward to it. And since Fred didn't say it, I'll say it. He's updated his book, by the way, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. So if you haven't read that yet, or even if you had, I'd On behalf of Frederick, I would say, go get it. It's a good book.
It's a great book, and it's an update for the 50th anniversary. Check it out, Frederick Stonehouse. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today. Stay tuned for more on WPR News, and return again tomorrow for the Larry Mueller Show when we have Shyler Mergane helping us through the holidays. We'll take a look at fundraising for multiple sclerosis and how it has led to medical breakthroughs, plus answers to your menopause questions tomorrow from 11 to 1 on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn. Broke deep enough.